Gray, Real One. Irene, could I ask you first of all something about your background? You know, if you could tell me where you were born and brought up and the sort of family life you had.
Yes, I am now almost an old lady of 83. So that I hope, if there are any slight inaccuracies, I might be forgiven. 50 years is a long time to remember from the war years. To start my story, then, I was born at the old Royal Victoria Military Hospital at Netley Abbey, now unfortunately demolished. My father was a serving member of the Royal Army Medical Corps, and of course he was stationed there. I myself have no memories at the time of Netley Abbey because, of course, I was too young. When I was 3 months old, my father was transferred to Leeds, so therefore my early memories are of an industrial city, not the lovely, pleasant area of Netley Abbey. My father at the time was medical instructor to the Royal Army Medical Corps Territorial, stationed in Leeds. We had a fairly large house opposite the military barracks, obviously. Life continued very happily there. There was my beloved father and mother, of course. I had two brothers, two sisters, and myself. I was the baby of the family. When my eldest brother reached the age of 17, or thereabouts, he also wanted to follow in father's footsteps. And he subsequently also joined the Royal Army Medical Corps, taking his training, of course, at Aldershot. My younger brother, then, had just started employment shortly after leaving school. But within a space of my eldest brother leaving to join the Royal Army Medical Corps, I think it must have been only about 9 months, my beloved father had a stroke early one Sunday morning, and he died at 3 o'clock the same afternoon, leaving my mother, of course, now absolutely wouldn't say destitute, but obviously they were a devoted couple, and life now took on a totally different aspect with not having father, because in those days life was very much harder than it is now. I have memories of a smoky industrial city. And of course, in the 1914-18 war, my earliest memory here is of childhood, of course, looking out of the top bedroom window and seeing on the landscape the fires of the various steel smelting forges. And following on, the Zeppelin raids coming in over the North Sea. Our house was a semi-basement house. Father, of course, now was away in Flanders. But I can remember Mother bringing my sister and I and my other brother downstairs to sit in the basement, putting a blanket up at the window, obviously to keep light out, just with one candle. But my most vivid memory is of a Zeppelin coming down in flames. At the time, I did not realize, of course, what it was. And a terrific explosion. We were naturally, as children, frightened. But I remember my mother's calm voice saying, "It's all right, dear. Excuse me. They have just shot a poor old horse in the barracks that was injured." And, of course, that settled us down, needless to say. But those memories of her struggle will always remain with me. She was a wonderful mother, and I look back now with gratitude.
Did you get any sort of impression of the war from your father being in Flanders?
Not really at the time. When he did come home, if anybody started the subject, he was very loath to discuss anything. But I do know that I felt very proud in later years. At the time, it didn't mean anything. But I have in my possession now a framed certificate signed by Winston Churchill, who was Secretary of State for War at the time, where my father was mentioned in dispatches on the field. But for what purpose, we never knew, and I still do not know. He would not talk about it.
You would have been, of course, a very small child at this time,
yes.
Wouldn't you?
Yes.
Yes.
I was born in 1913.
Yes, so you were five when the war ended.
That's right.
Mm. Do you remember, you know, anything, you know, that lovely image about the Zeppelin? Are there other things about the war or the aftermath that you remember?
Not really from Leeds. We lived... The barracks, the Royal Military Barracks, was opposite to us where we lived. And at the time, they had a very big drill square. Ambulances, of course, then were horse-drawn, obviously. And I can remember playing as a child on the drill square with other children. And there was a riding school there, of course, where the men were taught to ride. And I have visions of sometimes creeping in there, completely forbidden, it shouldn't have been. And there was, of course, a gallery for observers. It was, of course, a peat floor, but I can remember very vividly the horses in practice belting round the square. And in one or two particular instances, I was in disgrace because we shouldn't have been in the riding school as little children, but we crawled up in the gallery to watch the men. There was one particular groom. He was an enormous man, and he was, quite definitely, a genuine cowboy who came from Texas. Needless to say, he was a wonderful horseman. And I have always been a small person. And as he sometimes belted round the drill square on the horse, he would stoop down, pick me up in his arms and put me in front of him and go careering round the riding square until my father saw him, and then Russians flew. Who gave you permission to take my tiny daughter? My father had the rank of captain, but I haven't really any other memories apart from the excitement of the odd occasions when father used to come home, the thrill and excitement.
How about the armistice? Did that mean anything to you as a small child?
Not really. I really have no memories of that. It must have been, obviously, one of the happy periods, but my father didn't come home until some time after that. And I must have been then, I suppose, about six, because when father came home, the war finally... His army career in the war zone finally ended because of the end of hostilities. He was transferred to a Ministry of Pensions hospital at known as Beckett's Park near Leeds. And there he stayed, of course, until that terrible afternoon when he had a stroke and I no longer had a father. And I have missed him ever since. I still feel sometimes when I see a married woman, an older woman, with a happy father, I find myself thinking, what have I missed? I would have loved to have grown up with a father. Although, as I say, my mother was a wonderful mother. We never, wanted for anything.
How about your education, Irene?
I started when I was 5 years old, of course, at a Church of England primary school, known as St. George's School in Leeds. And looking back over the years, compared to now, it was very basic. But the whole of my education was spent there. As I came out of the primary school, you were, of course, moved up. It was a very solid old building, been there for years. And I look back on it now and think, how really did we manage? It was terribly cold. But I can also look back. I left school at 14, spent the whole of my years there. But when I look back now and consider how, of course, education has advanced so many subjects, I still maintain that that Church of England school gave everybody a thoroughly good basic training. We could all read and write, we were all legible, good at spelling, the things that seem to be ignored now. But anyway, at 14, I left school, and unemployment was very rife then. It really was. 2 days before I left school, the headmaster called me in with one or two other girls of my age group and said a local firm had contacted him to see if they had anybody suitable as an office girl to be trained further. He sent myself and about four other girls for the interview. And this was at a clothing factory known at the time as J. Hepworth. It is now Montagu Burton's. But it was a very big factory. And anyway, I went for the interview, and much to my surprise, I was told to start the next day, which I did. My commencing salary was 8 shillings a week. The old 8 shillings a week, which of course I brought home. My mother had 7 shillings and I had 1 shilling. Because, obviously, we all had to contribute to the family income. I stayed with the firm for about a year. And much to my surprise, the branch manageress of the office, it was a very large office, incidentally, called me in one day and said shortly her own typist would be leaving in about 6 to 9 months' time, and she would like me, if possible, to take her place. At the time, of course, I had no knowledge of shorthand and typing. I was merely a little modest office girl. And although it may sound stupid, I knew full well that my mother could not afford to pay for my training. This I explained to the manageress, and she said, "Will you ask your mother to come and see me?" Which I did, with fear and trembling in my feet, thinking I'd done something wrong, obviously. But the outcome of it was that the manageress understood my mother's financial difficulties, because it was very, very commonplace in those days. No social services to fall back on, no nothing. And she asked my mother if she would agree, to let me be tutored privately instead of night school, and the firm would pay for my training. Needless to say, my mother spoke to me first to see how I felt about it, and it was progression, so I did. And I therefore went privately about 2 nights a week to one of the senior typists on the firm, to her home. And in about 6 months, I had managed to hold my own and could take shorthand dictation and typing. I unfortunately never quite achieved to the object of replacing her own shorthand typist, for the simple reason that by now my father had been dead. He died in 1923. My father had been dead probably 2 years now. My mother was a Southampton woman. All her sisters lived in Southampton. And although she tried very, very hard, she found it almost impossible to settle and be happy. So with terrific courage, I think, looking back on those days, my eldest sister, who was also employed at Beckett's Park Hospital, and my other sister had to give their notice in, which was a very severe thing to do in those days because unemployment was so rife, she decided to come back to Southampton. So it also meant, of course, it was a terrific gamble in those years. But she made all the arrangements. She contacted a sister who lived in Southampton, who agreed to take us all in as a family until mother could find somewhere to live. Consequently, all my mum's furniture was collected by the railway, brought to Southampton, and put in store for quite some considerable time. Eventually, we arrived at Southampton, and I remember getting off the train at what was then the old, known as the Central Station in Southampton. And I remember standing on the platform and looking at the sea and being thrilled to bits from a smoky city. Anyway, we stayed with my aunt for about, I think, 4 months. And then my mother did manage to find a flat. So, of course, we all settled back again as far as possible, a happy family. But we were, even without my dear father, a united family always. But then my first job, I started in Southampton, I started at what was then a vulcanizing factory in New Road, Southampton, still well known, the name, P.C. Oxborough. I was there for about 2 years, I think, and with two other girls. But I must admit, Mr. Oxborough, the man himself who owned the firm, was a rather difficult man to get on with. He changed his mind every 5 minutes. He was a very nice, kind man. But I think some of his attitudes really was reminiscent of his service in the war years. He had almost lost his hearing. He was in the Royal Artillery, and due to the blasts, etc., it had affected his eardrums. And he used to become very temperamental. And suddenly, without any warning, he went to London one day to pick up what was known then as tyre cases suitable for retreading. And while he was in London, he phoned back to the firm, which I took the phone call, to sack everybody on the spot, for which we never knew the reason, but consequently that was the end of my service with PC Oxborough. The firm did start up again sometime afterwards, but with totally different staff. But we never knew, any of us, the reason for dismissal. I was then out of work for about 3 months, I think, and I managed to obtain employment as cashier at the old Cadena Cafe in the High Street, Southampton. This was quite hair-raising because it was in the days when various liners were in Southampton, in the heyday of the transatlantic liners. And periodically there used to be visits from various towns and things to view the liners in the dock. And they used to then, after their tour was over, descend into the Cadena Cafe for a cup of tea. The cash desk was situated near the door, and sometimes you had absolutely crowds of people in for their cup of tea, and we were held responsible, the other cashier and I, for ensuring that everybody paid their bill before they went out. When you have a crowd of people, as we did then, invariably a man would come and say, "Oh, it's all right, I'm in charge of such and such a party. I'm paying it all in one." You couldn't query it. And if anybody went out on their own, we used to have to bawl out, "Pay here, please," which I felt terrible about. At the end of the day, when we had to check up the waitress's little bar to cash up in the evening, with the big chart entering everything, every bill number that had been paid, there was invariably several that had not been paid. The professionals had just slipped out with the crowds. And therefore, we had to make good any bill that hadn't been paid. I do remember coffee was only sevenpence a cup then, but nevertheless, my wage then was 11 shillings a week with responsibility. So, obviously, I decided I just could not cope with that. Sometimes I had no money to give my mother the week. So, anyway, I was, with the other girl, sacked because we were held responsible. In a way, it turned out all to the good for me. I was once again unemployed for about 3 months. Going to the Labour Exchange, as it was then, every day, to see if they had any vacancies. One day I went there and I was told that there was an application for a job in my line, but it was a highly confidential job, and I would have to be, whoever got the job, would have to be very careful and never divulge anything. It was a highly confidential job. They wouldn't say where it was or anything, but I had to go home first and write a letter of application. When they had got all the letters of application in, they would then send them to the chief of the firm concerned for his consideration. I duly came home, and it was a walk of 2 miles home from the employment exchange to where I lived. I could not afford a penny for the car, for the it was tramway system then. But I came home duly, wrote the letter, and took it back again, with the instructions to report back in 2 days, by which time they would have had the replies from the firm concerned, still not saying where the firm was. 2 days later, I go, and I was told I had got an interview with about 4 other girls, of course, and it was at the Supermarine Aviation Works at Hythe, not Southampton. Hythe, of course, was the flying boat base. I went over there, and I, if I remember rightly, the Hythe Pier is one of the longest in our country, at least it was at the time. It was almost a mile long, extending way out into Southampton water. You crossed from Southampton by the Hythe Ferry, and when you landed at Hythe Ferry, Hythe Pier, you either had to walk the pier or pay a penny for the little electric train that ran up. It was a teeming wet morning, I shall always remember it. Rain was pouring off me, and I couldn't afford a penny for the electric tram. So I walked the whole length of Hythe Pier, thinking with dread in my heart, an interview with rain teeming off me. But eventually I got to the firm. The other 4 girls had all caught the train up, and they were nice and dry. We all sat in the interview room waiting. When my turn came, I felt absolutely ridiculous because rain was just pouring off me and I was standing in a pool of water. When I was shown into the chief's room, I shall always remember him. He was a middle-aged man sitting behind his desk, looking very important, as you can imagine. I crept in, a tiny little figure with rain streaming off me, and he just looked at me and he bellowed with laughter. And he said, "You poor kid, you are wet, aren't you?" So I said, "Yes, sir, I am." And he just said to me, still roaring with laughter, "I suppose you can do shorthand and typing." I said, "Yes, sir, that is why I am here." And he just laughed. He said, "All right, start Monday," without giving me a test of any kind. He said, "You're much too wet to take a test. I'll take you on trust." Whether or not it was my wet appearance, I don't know. But that started my employment with the Supermarine Aviation Works.
Who was that man?
He's dead now. His name was, his surname was Birt, B-I-R-T. And he was a very nice man. I felt very much at home with him. But I was the only female employee in the whole of Hythe Works. And I think the employment force of the males, if I remember rightly, was somewhere, I might be wrong on this, of course, was somewhere in the region of 300 to 500 men. But never once did I have any cause for complaint. Entirely the reverse. In those days, the majority of men, as I see it, were gentlemen. It was very funny also. Although I was secretarial, I had to clock on the same as the men did. Clock on and off. Firms' rules were very rigid, and if you were late at the office, say 5 minutes, you lost a quarter of an hour's pay. At night time, I think the hours were till 5 o'clock at night, and the ferry back to Southampton was about 5:15. It was quite a long walk from the firm to the ferry. And my little legs would come out with the men, with the whole crowd of men, if we were a little bit late. And very often, two of the men would roar and say, come on, you won't catch it. And they'd catch me under each arm and virtually carry me off to the ferry. It was a very happy time of employment. And I look back with interest also, because it was almost the end of the era of the flying boats. They were being phased out. It was a very interesting job, because at the time, flying boats were coming back from various RAF bases for modification in some way or other. And I also had responsible, of course, for a very small switchboard there. I would probably get a call from one of the RAF bases, mainly the Royal Air Force Base at Calshot, as it was then. And I would probably get a coded message merely stating something like, Southampton flying boat number S-1038, left Felixstowe, pilot, flight lieutenant, so-and-so, en route for Hythe, ETA, which meant expected time of arrival, giving me the time they expected. From then, I had to watch Southampton water, and in the distance you'd hear the drone of an aircraft engine, and I'd see her in the far distance land, taxi up to the firm. And as soon as she had landed, I had to radio back again to say, obviously, that she had landed. It was very interesting. We had a test pilot at the time when he took a Southampton flying boat up for test. He was virtually known as, he must have been mad, so the men said. You will obviously remember his name. Flying Officer Biard, B-I-A-R-D. And here's the pilot's office was next door to mine, separated only by a thin plaster wall. Behind that wall was a built-in table fixed to the wall. Before Flying Officer Biard took a machine up, his hobby was knife throwing. And he used to go into the pilot's room and spend 2 or 3 minutes throwing knives into the wall that landed a few inches from my nose sitting on the other side. But you learnt to accept it. It was a flying officer Biard, and everybody understood. Anyway, the era of the flying boat was beginning to come to an end, obviously.
What date would that have been, Irene?
Just let me think back. I was at Supermarine 23. I'm talking to myself now. Somewhere in the region, 1937. Somewhere about 1930, I imagine, 29-30. Because then the Hythe Works closed down, the end of the flying boat era, and I was transferred to Woolston, which, of course, was the head office of the firm. Now, by now, of course, R.J. Mitchell, who was employed at the Woolston Works, obviously, as chief designer, was busily engaged on the Spitfire project. So from flying boats now, I was switched to technicalities on the Spitfire. But I shall remember R.J. Mitchell. He was held with affection right throughout the firm. He was a very quiet man, but obviously a brilliant man. And I have seen him walk through the main erecting shops, and he would sit perhaps on a staging somewhere, doing nothing, just thinking. And if you didn't know who he was, think, what's the matter with that man? But obviously his brain was ticking over. He was looking at one of the machines there, and he would suddenly make his mind up, put his pipe back in his mouth, who was an inveterate pipe smoker, and go to the chief erector and just say something like, strip her down. He had thought of something, you know, that would, some modification. And this went on for ages, obviously, till you know the story of the Spitfire. But by the time she took her first flight from Eastleigh Aerodrome, RJ now was a very sick man, and he watched the first flight, so I am told, from his wheelchair. But he just had time to see her in action. and the test pilot who at the time who took her up on her first test flight was pilot, I think he was pilot officer, I might be wrong on his rank, Somers, S-O-M-E-R-S.